Tonight we're going to explore the science of dialogue, mindful listening and mindful speaking. The title was posted as mindful speaking and listening, but when I practice this and when I teach this and share it with others, it's listening first. I have to be able to listen to what's coming out of my mouth first. Have you heard of a blue moon? That's the second full moon of within a single month. I didn't know it, but today's a black moon. It's the second new moon of July, and it peaks in about 2 hours. So if any of you are a little bit kind of buzzed, welcome to the club. We can ride that energy together. It affects us all. I mean, you know, it's just a lot of gravitational pull on our internal solar systems. Years ago, when I was first learning how to give these talks, and I was studying with monastics, the wise ones shared with me that it's always a good idea to, before we start a talk, to sit and to kind of get our instruments acclimated to the same humidity, so to speak. The next thing would be to maybe quickly take the refuges. So I want to do that, but I want to do it in a very secular way. It'll sound traditional. No, namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Buddham saranam gacchami means I take refuge in the Buddha. Now, it sounds like I'm proselytizing, but the way I like to spin this today in our culture is I take refuge in the Buddha nature of the present moment. And so this is part of my practice. This is how I come to the, this is how I practice. I take refuge, like what we just did on the cushion, hopefully was an invitation for the body to relax and maybe the heart mind to relax. When I say heart mind, I'm talking about the emotional nature as well as the intellectual nature, to settle down so that we could actually be present regardless and okay with whatever was arising. The discomfort in the knees, the boredom, the sleepiness, et cetera, et cetera. And possibly there was a few moments of stillness. For some, maybe there was connected moments of stillness. Maybe even some bliss. That'd be great, huh? But for most of us, there was this kind of yada, yada, yada going on because that's how the mind works. So I can take refuge in the Buddha nature. I can take refuge in the power of now, as Eckhart Tolle puts it in one of his books, his first book, one of his greatest books. The power of now, the simplicity of this moment. This is where life happens. This is where I can experience only whatever I can experience right now. It may be pleasant, it may be unpleasant, maybe neither. I'm either awake or I'm in a trance. Right this minute, I take refuge in the moment right now, Buddha nature. Dhammam saranam gacchami. I take refuge in the Dhamma or the Dharma. The teachings, and they say the teachings, the system that's been around is good in the beginning, the middle, and the end. One of the beauties of the teachings is they tend to morph and adjust to the environment they're in, the culture they're being taught in. It's great, you know. 5,000 years ago, they were speaking in northern India. Now we're talking in Washington, D.C. Things have changed a little bit. Human nature hasn't changed too much. But our cultures have evolved a lot. So I can take refuge in these teachings. When I first really ran into the teachings back in the late 60s, you know, it was Vietnam era. I was lost. I was confused. I was angry. I didn't have a clue. I didn't trust anybody. I was on edge. And I stumbled into some Eastern philosophies and I started reading this. I started studying that and listened to so-and-so. You know, Alan Watts, big guy back then, some of you remember him, you know, Ram Dass, that crew. D.T. Suzuki back in the old days. I'm seeing some nods. And it made sense. The Dhamma, the teachings made sense. There was a logic to it. And one of the pieces I loved the most was, don't believe what you read, don't believe what you hear, what somebody tells you, but go ahead and digest it, and if it digests, trust your own sensations, trust your own experience. And I said, well, that makes some sense. I can at least experiment with this. And it got me going. It got me back, you know, gave me some direction. The last piece of this, they call this the triple gem, taking the refuges. Sangam Saranam Gacchami in Pali. That means I take refuge in the Sangha. And that's the community. That's us. That's those of us that meditate together, that have found one path or another, one system or another. It all depends, you know. Each one of us is exploring. You wouldn't be here tonight if you weren't. Exploring some kind of path of awakening. That's the short version. Self-awareness, however, whatever you want, self-realization, however you want to put it. And I just, the reason I'm doing this is because for decades, I got into this a long time ago, for decades, right away, I got the power of the Buddha nature. I was like, okay, Zen, I can do this. Boy, concentration, all that stuff. I trusted the teachings. And I, the more I tested them, the more they seemed to work. They were repeatable. This seems to work. This is good advice, good medicine. I didn't get taking refuge in the Sangha. Because the way I'd been brought up. I didn't understand community. I didn't know how to be in a healthy relationship. It didn't make sense. I didn't have trouble making relationships, you know. Kind of a serial monogamist, including business partnerships, you know. I was a small businessman for years and years, and I would, this business and then this business, you know. But after two or three or four years, a nuclear catastrophe. Shakespearean tragedies, I call them. And they tended to repeat themselves until I was in my mid-40s. I said, I can't afford this anymore. You know, psychologically, emotionally, physically, I was out of it. So I found my way back to this practice. Back in the mid-90s. And that's when I met Tara and we built IMCW. So here we are. But I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't know what I was coming back to, really. So since then, this I take refuge in the Sangha, this last piece, I take refuge in the power of community, has changed my life. I didn't understand it. Made sense. But it was like I was balancing on two wheels or something, and half of a triangle. And finally, you know, something happened. I got it. A lot of it had to do with learning how to do the loving kindness practice, the metta practice, or the compassion practices, karuna, understanding sympathetic and altruistic joy. But mostly, and how this developed for me, was right from the get-go, when we were getting together, building IMCW, or as groups and small groups, or you know, just a handful of folks. Some of you are here tonight. It's great to see you. Takes me way, way back. Tara handed out a book called Wisdom Circles. How to be in a circle. Remember where you pass the stick and something. You talk, you have the stick, it's your turn, everybody listens. You give the stick to him or he takes the stick or whatever. We would bow in and bow out, we didn't pass the stick. And so we developed this way of interacting in groups because the groups were small, or 15, 20, but even then you could do it. And we practiced. What was the object of meditation? The object of meditation was whoever was speaking. We'd sit for a while. I watch the breath. I'm fucking, the breath is very elusive, particularly this time of night. I watch about 7 breaths. And I'm out cold, you know, or my mind's redoing tomorrow's to-do lists. So this power, this thing called dialogue, David Bohm is a theoretical physicist. And for some reason, he decided to put this system together. He used the word dialogue. When I say dialogue, you just, what do you think of? You think of conversations and things like that, probably, right? But the word he used was dialogue for a system of really being present with each other in group dynamics, where we would, first of all, honor silence. Not necessarily first of all, but I would, when someone had the floor, they either had the talking stick or we bowed in or whatever it was, And that person was free to say anything they wanted to say. And everybody would listen and hold the space. So it was like a group getting together. It was like a musical ensemble of folks that came together. And the wisdom circle thing morphed into, how many of you have heard of the spiritual friends groups that IMCW has? A few? Okay. Back then we used to call them KM groups, Kalyanamitta. Kalyanamitta was the is the Pali phrase for spiritual friends. And I think there's 30, 40, 50 of them now. I have no idea how many there are. But I've been in one for 22 years. There's 10 of us. And it's a few people have changed and come and gone, but the core is still there. And we use this process of dialogue right from day one. This was part of the guidelines that were put in there. We would sit together for 20 or 30 minutes, and the different groups have different kind of formats, but most of them are kind of like this. We sit together for 30 or 40 minutes just to calm down. Then we check in. So I bow in. I talk for a few minutes about what my sit was like or whatever's going on in life or whatever's really calling for my attention. I bow out. And then you check in. Whatever, you know, what's happening? What's going on? And by the time we got around the 3, 4, 5, 10 people, however many were there that night, generally a theme had sort of kind of organically emerged. And if we're all mindful, if we're all paying attention and really listening, we're all tuned to that, like coming back to the musical ensemble. We sit together, that's like the instruments getting tuned up or getting acclimated. Then we check in, that's like tuning up the instruments because we're not really on the same page yet. Something emerges, that's like picking a piece of music. And then imagine what it's like when, say, 8 people sitting in a circle start to discuss or have dialogue about that subject that has organically emerged. There's a sense of convergence in the room. There's that sense of harmony, like the musicians have decided, well, we're gonna play this piece of music tonight. So you have 8 different perspectives, possibly. I may agree with yours. I may totally disagree with yours, but it doesn't matter. I can learn from your perspective. My perspective is limited. There's I got to play with perspective for a second here. Go with me. You guys in the middle, you'll figure it out. What color is this? Anybody? Huh? Blue. All right, good. What color is this? White. Okay. What size is this? I mean, what's the shape? What's this? Square. What's the shape? A circle. Okay, so let's just pretend like, okay, and you guys are seen as a straight line. You don't know it's blue or white. Maybe you can't tell. But so through meditation or through dialogue, we get to share perspectives. Is this all you ever saw? This would be your reality. This is what your mind believes. Your mind locks into this. It holds it true. It'll defend it to the death and vice versa, right? It's hard for us to get on the same page about anything. But based on circumstances and conditions, our reality can evolve and morph. And this is another way, so many of you, this is the Insight Meditation Community of Washington, IMCW, Insight, Vipassana, to see clearly into. To see clearly into the phenomena that's unfolding right in this moment. There's one thing to be sitting here in the kind of bandwidth or the mental bandwidth that we're right now, and kind of reflect on this or that. There's another to get really, really deeply concentrated in meditation. I'm going to come back around and talk about that in a minute. Because then we can start to investigate into whatever it is in much more of a microscopic or subtle way and begin to understand the nature of things, or particularly understand how our mind deals or is caught up in perspective, beliefs. I call them sticky notes. There's this palace of possibilities we live in, this beautiful palace of possibilities, endless rooms of things we could be doing. But most of us live in one little room. My room's called John. And the walls are covered with sticky notes of belief systems. I like to say I'm an encyclopedic anthology of likes and dislikes. You know what I mean? I'm just a pile of habits, remanufacturing myself every minute. John, the ego, is just that's part of my brain's job. But I believe it as though it's real. I buy into it. So one of these things with this dialogue, the power of dialogue, you know, it goes two ways. When it's my turn to speak, when I'm bowing in, first of all, I'll sit there like this, you know, and we don't call on each other. It's just, oh, there's an impulse to speak. There's an impulse to speak. Impulse to speak. I check in. Is what I'm going to say going to improve upon silence, number one? You know, is it really going to improve upon silence? Is it relevant? Am I just going to give, you know, kind of a travelogue of the last week's events? Am I offering anything that could deepen our understanding of whatever the subject matter has converged into? Often I'll notice that my impulse is bubbling up, bubbling up, bubbling up. And I say, you know, I'm not so sure. Huh. And I'll let the, just like when you're sitting and meditating and you're sitting like this and you're not, and you know, in the beginning when we first meditate, there's that itch. You know, oh yeah. And then after you've been meditating a while, there's the itch and you get to hear and you say, oh, okay. And then later on, there's the, and you twitch. It's like a dog that's learned to sit and heel, you know, it's just every dog that runs by once. Okay, but eventually there's the impulse to scratch, and I can watch the impulse. I've gotten so subtle, I can watch the impulse. The itch may get really loud, but I can feel that impulse, and I can say, okay. And then finally, I watch it evaporate. And if I'm mindful, a lot of times it'll evaporate, and then I'll say, oh, it's gone later. I didn't even notice when it left. So when you start to do this with our own thoughts, our own impulses to speak, if we're listening and paying attention, being mindful, if we're in there, I can feel the impulse. And I start to go bow in. A lot of times, ooh, I can't wait to talk. Oh, okay, calm down. And what started to happen was that the next I'd let it pass. And the next person, or maybe the next person after that person, would bow in and offer a perspective that was the same as mine, and often, quite often, unfortunately, much more eloquently than I would have. You know? I said, whoa, there's this thing called morphic resonance. And I could feel that the bandwidth of the room was, you know, beginning to gel. So what David Bohm discovered in his theoretical physics was that through dialogue, we could actually experience in a group setting that sense of harmony and connectedness. I take refuge in the Sangha. This is what it feels like. I've been in this group 22 years. There's folks in there I still don't really like. Same old issues. God, when are you going to get one? You know, right? Oh, I see some movement. I almost quit two or three times. Oh, this isn't working for me. And I stuck it out. And I'm so glad I did. Because it's helped me grow up. It's helped me relax. It's helped me. I don't necessarily like these folks. But I love every single one of them. On our 20th anniversary, we were reflecting. We sat, we had the subject. Why are we still here? What's it about? What's the core? And what came up, what converged kind of universally, organically, was this deep, deep, abiding mutual respect we had for one another. Absolute respect. Whether we agreed with our issues, or our personality differences and things like, you know, yes, and we've been together long enough to be quite a dysfunctional group. But at the same time, you know, and we all come together, we have diverse lives, we have different ways that we meditate. We all meditate, but the different kinds of practice backgrounds. We sit, we honor that. We honor the silence. There may be a minute, 2 minutes between people sharing. Sometimes it gets animated and, you know, you can't wait to get in and, you know, that turns into conversation. And then if somebody's there, you know, we take turns facilitating, someone just go over and go, oh yeah, let's come back. But almost always, it's such a rare occasion when I don't walk out of that place really, really in love. In what, to me, metta or loving kindness or loving friendliness feels like. That sense of connectedness with other human beings. I'm a lone wolf. I've mentioned that before, you know. I didn't understand healthy relationships. I didn't understand how to communicate. I didn't understand how to listen. Many of you have probably done some work with nonviolent communication. What's the guy's name? Williamson? Marshall Rosenberg, back in the 60s. Nonviolent communication. Surprised I can't remember that. But when I studied it, and it swept through IMCW, everybody was going to workshops and things like this. But when I studied it, I realized that his whole core, he says, what is communication about? Why do we communicate? Well, we communicate so we can get our needs met. Pretty simple. We don't do anything without a payoff. We communicate to get our needs met. Why do we have to even have a subject or a technique or a skill set called nonviolent communication? What's that about? And I got into the pieces of it. And, you know, the whole thing is based on generosity. It starts with being generous and a generous heart, an open heart, a loving heart. So for me to sit in a group, and when you're speaking, I don't know you, but I might learn something from you. And if I'm absolutely focused, if you become the object of my meditation, if I can place my attention on you, which means I am also aware of my, right now, a lot of you, as I'm speaking, there's sort of this subtext going on, and there's this parallel thinking, you're comparing, you're doing whatever you're doing, and just notice that and see if you can just suspend it for at least a few sentences. Not so you hear me better, just so you can know you can do it. Because when does this really make a difference? It's when you're home with the kids or your wife or your boss or your subordinates or something. And it isn't going well. And it's getting louder and louder. And, you know, we're starting to tense up and I'm starting to get reactive and tighten up. What's that about? Well, one of us isn't getting our needs met. Almost always. And it gets violent. That feeling of fight, flight, freeze, and the reactivity and the way I emote, the way I'm conditioned. I'm an encyclopedic anthology of likes and dislikes, a pile of habits. And I will think, speak, and act the way I know how. But the more I practice, the more I can find alternate, more subtle, and much more compassionate ways and generous ways to be in relationship. Doesn't mean, you know, I drop my guard and let people run over me. Still got to, you know, learn how to draw boundaries. My need is to have a strong boundary here. In dialogue, if somebody's speaking and I don't understand them, when it's my turn, I'll say, so-and-so, you said X, Y, Z. I'd like to inquire into that. Could you elaborate a little bit more on X, Y, and Z? Okay. That can help me understand better. That feeling of connectedness. And it happens all the time. It really does. And Tara knew all of, I mean, you know, she's a wizard at this stuff. And that's how we built IMCW. That's the groundwork. That's the fundamental on which, and I had no idea what I was getting into, where it was going to head, and the effect that it was going to have on my life, my own maturity, my well-being, the relationships I'm in now. It's amazing. Good medicine. So I'm going to bring this back around, and they call it the science, you know, and this practice is based on what's called the Four Noble Truths. Probably you've all heard this before. Yes? No? Okay. So, the big fella, you know, he'd been working on this for 6 years, hadn't figured it out yet. One night he stayed up underneath a tree, decided I'm not going to go to sleep until I get this problem solved. This problem, I don't even know what the problem is, but I'm going to solve this problem anyway. I've been out here looking for it. I've done everything, and blah, blah, blah. And so, poof, one thing led to another. He learned how to meditate, and he didn't invent this. He rediscovered what's already there for every single one of us. Inside each one of us is the capacity to awaken, okay? And he came out of the woods. He was kind of glowing. He was feeling pretty good. And he went back to his group of other monastics that had been practicing austere practices where they, you know, really, really, you know, they were so skinny they were about to die and everything. And they looked at him. He's kind of fat and healthy and looked good. And they said, "Wow, what's going on with you?" And you know, first they ostracized him. And they said, "Wait a second. He's looking really good. He's figured something out. What is it?" And he had to figure out what to say. He says, "Well, I understand suffering. I understand the source of suffering, that we all suffer. We all have stress. That's what this practice is all about. That's the first noble truth, period. It's all about stress. I understand now the cause of suffering and stress. I understand that we can actually live without suffering and stress. And I understand now how to do that." Four noble truths. Stress and suffering. Pali word is dukkha. The cause is my own mind that wraps around this is blue or this is white, this is square, this is round, this is that. That I believe, I buy into this thing I call John. And it gets kind of, particularly as an adult, it finally stops growing. It forgets to be curious. It stops learning. It knows what it knows. You know? My mind grabs around it. The part of the mind that drives the mind is what they call craving. The word tanha. The mind wants what it wants. When things, I repeated pleasant, unpleasant, neutral many, many times. So phenomena, whether it's physical, intellectual, psychological, emotional, physiological, spiritual, there's always phenomena happening. This system is responding or reacting to it. It's either pleasant, it's unpleasant, or it's neither pleasant or unpleasant. It's called neutral. That's just part of the science. And then what do we do with that information? It happens like this, nanosecond to nanosecond. So the mind, when things are good, it craves and wants to hold on to that dearly. Or a concept or an idea or a belief system, the sticky note on the wall. When things are not going well, when things are unpleasant, the mind wants them to be other than they are. How often have you heard Tara say, "I'll be okay someday when things work out, the kids graduate, da 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 da, okay? I'll be okay someday when." So the source of our suffering and stress is my mind holding on to this or pushing away that. The degree to which I do not see and understand this is kind of a veil. What this practice does is help me understand that and get into it. I'm not going to be free of pain. Pain is inevitable. Old age, sickness, death, taxes, wanting something, then getting it and being afraid of losing it, you know. Pain, broken arms, toothaches, insomnia. I'm hungry. There's a pizza. Oh, there's the pizza. I eat a piece of pizza. I want another piece of pizza. Now I've had too much pizza. Okay, you know. So you know, it's pain is inevitable. Suffering and stress is optional in this practice. So once I get that, I can experience the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. One of the most important little pieces of teaching that has helped me along is where I am constantly encouraged by my teachers to pay attention and to note those moments when there's a lack of suffering. It doesn't mean I'm blissed out. It doesn't mean I'm having one of those, you know, ecstasy moments on the cushion when I'm going to the jhanas and these kinds of things. Those are fun and cool and everything. But, you know, sometimes it's just the lack of suffering, the lack of stress. Often that comes on and it would be called neutral, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It's so neutral. It's so neutral I don't notice it. But the beauty of noticing and becoming familiar with neutral, or neither stress or not, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant, is the fact that it's not unpleasant. It's that simple. The cessation of stress. And if I can start to notice those things, I can start to condition. I'm this encyclopedic anthology of likes and dislikes. I can start to condition my mind to be more alert to when things are actually okay, peaceful, contented. I was at the end of a month-long retreat back a long time ago. And there was a guy, he's still here. And I look back in the corner, he looks like Jack Kornfield back in the corner there. And I said, wow, Jack's here. Wow, this is great. And, you know, but anyway, one of the teachers, Tara was one of the teachers, it was monthly. And so every couple of days I'd go in and talk to Jack, you know, and he'd check in, how's the retreat going? And he knew me beforehand, we'd worked together and everything like that. But at this point, he was the teacher. So I go in there, and every time he'd meet me where I was. One day he's my brother, the next day he's a guru, the next day he's a psychologist, et cetera, et cetera. So at the end of the retreat, at the end of the month, it was my last interview with him. And I said, okay, Jack, well, we had a really good time, blah, blah, blah. What do you think? How should I focus my practice for the next year? And he looked at me, and it's a long time ago. And he said, well, you know, your mindfulness has always been good. Back goes way back. You got really concentrated on this retreat. I would spend the next year cultivating contentedness. I didn't say it, but inside I went. Just like that. And just my reaction. I mean, he read me like a book, right? That's what these teachers can do. And I'm like, whoa. Now, I watched myself go inside. I went, whoa, he's right on. Bullseye. Because I watched this happen. I could listen. I could hear it. So this mindful listening, it's, you know, what's happening inside, not only listening to what's happening outside. Going back to, I know that sounds are going to enter into the field of awareness. This is something I do when, you know, I'm at home meditating and they're doing leaf blowers are outside. It's driving me crazy, that sound. You know, I'm very reactive to sounds. I've got PTSD around sounds. I know that sounds are going to enter in the field of awareness. I'll hear them consciously or maybe like that in the background, white noise. I'll hear them subconsciously. I'll hear them all, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And then I set the intention that may each and every sound encourage this body and heart mind to relax, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, just to keep it rolling. Cultivate contentedness. Take refuge in the Sangha. So I'll go back to the Four Noble Truths. There's stress and suffering. There's the cause of stress and suffering, which is my mind that grasps onto wants the way things are, wants things that it doesn't like to be different than they are. There's the fact that I can see into this and I can watch this phenomena as it's developing, and I can choose to do something different. Every single moment of our life is a choice point. Taking refuge in the here and now means that if I am paying attention, I can watch when I'm zinged, when I get triggered by phenomena, because I'm always going to get triggered. Life just keeps throwing stuff at us. It's not easy. It's complicated. Old age, sickness, death, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? All the trials and tribulations. Call them the winds of change, the vicissitudes. What do I do with that, though? As an adult, how do I take responsibility for my own well-being moment to moment as life unfolds, particularly when the stress meter is high? If I'm hungry, angry, lonely, tired, or a combination of those, my guard's down. So the fourth noble truth is how to do this. I'm going to buzz through this in a hurry. Many of you heard this many, many times. But the fourth noble truth is called the Eightfold Path. This is like an eight-lane highway. And it's broken up into three sections. And you'll see why I'm tying all this together in a second. But the first one is called wise understanding. Wise understanding. And in the beginning, what is it I'm trying to understand? Well, I'm trying to understand the other three noble truths. There's suffering, the cause of suffering, and the fact that I can enjoy not having a toothache, for instance. Okay? Just understanding that. But then to begin to understand all the things that I may not understand. If I slow down and take a look, if I'm willing to investigate, How many times have you heard the acronym RAIN? Those of you who've been around for a while, I recognize, I acknowledge and accept, I investigate. Really get in and allow for vipassana, for insight to take place, so I can just not attach, not identify, get out of my habits. Do something different. Make a choice. Every moment's a choice point. Understanding. Wise understanding. Wise understanding is going to have a direct influence on how I think, how the mind functions, how I think. Because the more I understand, the more I'm penetrating into my own ignorance. Ignorance just means I don't know what I don't know. I'm ignorant of this or that, whatever it might be. I just don't know. So the deeper my understanding, the more my thinking is going to evolve, the more my natural, and these two are called the wisdom factors of the Eightfold Path. The next three are called the morality factors. Ethics, you know? Oh my God. But they're based in non-harming. They're based in generosity, non-harming of self and non-harming of others. This is where I take my practice, you know, that first refuge. I take refuge in Buddha nature. That's the meditation piece. The Dharma is what we're doing now, and the last part is the Sangha, where we're going to start talking about stuff, the communication piece. But this is the second three, the morality piece, is where I take it out into community. And it's built on what they call the precepts. And the precepts are guiding principles. They're not like commandments. And for lay people, we're lay people. Householders, there's five of them. Unless we go on a retreat, then there's eight. I undertake the training principle to refrain from causing harm. I undertake the training principle to refrain from taking anything that's not freely offered. This is, undertake the training principle to refrain from inviting in intoxicants to the point where they'll cause me to act heedlessly. For householders, we're allowed to have some wine. I undertake the training principle to refrain from sexual conduct that's going to cause harm to me, myself or someone else. I'm not a monastic here, you can tell, okay? Right? But there's one that stands alone. It's the third one in the Eightfold Path. I undertake the training principle to abide in wise speech. I don't lie. I don't try to break up relationships. I avoid divisive speech. This is where we go into, we start talking about politics. We're not going to go there. And, you know, all right? I undertake the training principle to refrain from harsh speech. This is one of the hardest ones for me. I grew up in a household where there was a lot of harsh speech. My dad was a sailor, and, you know, I've been told that one of my first words, I stubbed my toe or something, was "son bitch." And they, you know, I got a standing ovation in the moment, and so it stuck. And, you know, so I've been trying to wean that out. My wife says, you know, it's just not very dignified, John. And she means it, and she's right. She's a great feedback for me. Harsh speech. Idle speech. Wasting time. But speech is it's the third of the, wise understanding, wise thought, and now I'm moving out into the community, interacting in the Sangha. How do I speak? If I can't hear myself speak, I'm coming back to listening. The only way I can become mindful of my speaking is to actually listen to it, to pay attention. What's coming out of my mouth? One of the easiest little criteria is, will it improve upon silence? You know? Or am I often one of these things? For years, I used to embellish my stories to make myself a little bit grander because of my lack of self-confidence and my low self-esteem, according to the therapist. You know? So I would tend to, you know what I'm, I puff. I blow up my resume a little bit, or a lot. I find, what am I doing? I don't need to do that. So I overhauled it. It took a while. Piece by piece by piece. I feel better. I'm not BSing myself anymore, are you? I'm being as authentic as I can be, as real, as present, as open. There's a sense of vulnerability to it, but it's okay. The next one in the list, there's speech, and then there's what's called action, and that's the one that takes the other precepts. Non-harming, basically, how I act and interact. how I do things. The next one is livelihood or lifestyle. This is where I spend most of my waking hours. How do I live? What kind of work do I do? Is it non-harming? Is it okay? Is it gentle? Is it creating stress or reducing stress in our world situation? So those are called the morality factors, the Eightfold Path. The last three are the actual practice. The first one of those is effort or energy. And you heard me mention that. If you're sleepy, can you bring a little more energy to your meditation? If there's a sense of striving, oh, I'm really going to pay attention to the breath here. Okay, calm down. But do I even know that I'm striving? Do I know that I'm snoozing? And what's it take to adjust and calibrate? How much energy or effort do I really need to bring here? And all these can be expanded a lot. The one after that is the one we all know about, mindfulness. Everybody thinks that mindfulness is the whole story in our culture today. Mindfulness is the big headline. But it's just part of the Eightfold Path. I can't do any of this without being mindful. Mindfulness means remembering to remember to be present. Remembering to guard the sense doors. What do I pay attention to? Remembering to guard the flock from the wolves. Knowing when I can relax because there's no wolves in the territory according to the wolf police. You know? You put all these together, and what's the eight to the Eightfold Path? That's the word concentration. And in this practice, concentration means undisturbed presence. It's not the kind of concentration of grinding. It's undisturbed presence. It's where I've finally gotten to that place. I'm either choiceless awareness, where I'm just watching the arising and passing of phenomena, or I'm using focused attention, for instance, on the breath, not necessarily just the breath, but whatever I've chosen, focused attention, and there's no disturbances. John disappears. I sat with the mountain and me, until only the mountain remained. I sat with the breath and me, until only the breath remained. John just goes, John's just an idea anyway. So it's really nice when the brain, that neural network of the brain, kind of relaxes. And it's visceral. We can feel it. And what's it lead to? It leads to a sense of presence that's quite profound. It leads to the possibility of vipassana, insight. It can lead to a concentrated state that goes through different levels of physiological phenomena. They call the rising of the jhanas, which can be extremely fun, you know, downright addicting. But after a while, you know, you get into a state of what's called equanimity, like that still forest pool. Imagine a pool, just for a second here, and it's so still that the surface is like a reflection, like a mirror. Anything that arises is instantly perceived. A little water bug can land on it from 20 feet away, you see it. If it's the wind's blowing, you could throw pebbles in, you wouldn't notice it. Drop a rock in, you wouldn't notice it. But it's so still, so undisturbed, that maybe the silt's settled to the bottom. So not only can you see a clear reflection, a clear luminous reflection in the moment, in now, you can look deeply into the moment and understand it in ways you may not have understood it before. Where the dots connect, the sense of aha happens, that just wonderful endorphin rush of aha, the insight, the vipassana. Oh, man. And normally what I'm seeing is my own stuff. I'm seeing those things. I'm seeing my conditioning, that anthology of likes and dislikes, the sticky notes on the wall that have kept me bound up, kept me small, kept me stuck in this one little room in the palace of possibilities. And all of a sudden, I can set myself free, at least for a minute or two, where I can experience the sense of equanimity, which is, just to say, the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. This all made sense to me. The piece in there that didn't was how to be in relationships. How to have, because this is where we get our buttons pushed. It's so easy. You know, we know each other. I was trying to raise my eyebrow and look at you with a funny look, but it didn't come off. You know, but, you know, I walk into the room and my wife does something and it pushes a button that goes back, you know, too many years, long before I met her. Old conditioning, happened the other night, as a matter of fact. We're driving. I'm excited about something. I start to talk about it. And she heard it. And what she did was she wanted to kind of make sure that my enthusiasm wasn't going to get me in trouble with some relatives and things. And so she came back with this kind of perspective, which was absolutely perfect on and everything like that. But what it did was, and I got this old conditioning thing we worked on, where all of a sudden, you know, I get in relationships where somebody will always dampen my enthusiasm. I'm never quite good enough, that kind of thing, that kind of dynamic. That's one of the things I play. And so she was saying it, and I just felt myself start to deflate. And I'm driving, I go, fuck. Okay? Now, I was just expressing how I was feeling. I was trying to be real and authentic. But that triggers her as harsh speech aimed at her. So now she's reactive. Okay? And so what was 30 seconds beforehand, 5 seconds beforehand, a very pleasant ride full of excitement, went south in a hurry. Now we know how to do this. We've been at this a long time. So there's this formation, this thing called dialogue, the science of dialogue, but there's another one, and there's a lot of these, nonviolent communication. There's another one called Imago. Some of you might have heard of Imago. And this is a really, really powerful, powerful technique for being in a relationship where when it's time, I get to talk and tell my story. The listener just listens. And then every now and then will stop me and say, hold on, and flat mirror me back. No spin, no interpretation, not even empathy at this point, just flat mirror. I heard you say. And then at the end, did I get it? Is there more? And if there's more to my story, then I go until that person can't remember anymore. And they say, hold on. And what happens is I am allowed to express myself. That person, the listener, and it's taken me a while to do this. She and I, we've been practicing this for years, and she's much better at it than I am. You know, where let's start over. I got to gather my head. So I can allow the speaker to be the object of my meditation. And when I'm allowing the speaker to be the object of my meditation, A, it comes from a place of generosity in my heart. I am giving my full attention. I'm truly giving my full attention to that person. The speaker can hear, can feel that. It comes from a place of respect. I may not agree with what's being said. I may not understand what's being said yet. That's not the point. I just flat mirror back. It's hard to do. It takes intention and energy, and both people have to play. When the story's done, then I say, okay, let me see if I can summarize it. Then I'll summarize the story. Did I get it? A lot of times I'll leave out certain salient pieces. So that comes up, then we process that. Do it again. But finally, the summary's done. And then I say, I imagine you must be feeling X, Y, Z. I haven't made it about me at all. How often do we always take over when we're in a conversation, you know, and somebody's barely finished a sentence and I'm already in there defending myself or making my point or whatever it is, you know, trying to be right. We are so attached to being right. We're almost never right completely. There's always another way to look at stuff. There's always more. So this technique, the Imago technique, works. And when that person is allowed to speak, they feel heard, they feel respected. And often when we have in relationship that sense of disconnect, you know, when it's not going well, you know how that hurts. What I've learned that as soon as possible, as soon as it's appropriate to sit down and invite the process, a process where we can do this, we may have to remodel a little bit. I may have to change my thought patterns. I may little behavior, this or that, whatever. We find a middle ground if we want to keep the relationship going. But what happens is there's a sense of reconnection. I take refuge in the Sangha, whether it's one person or everybody. There's a sense of reconnection, a wholeness, a sense of harmony based on respect and loving kindness. I love this practice, you know? I teach it all the time. I facilitate groups doing this. You know, use the dialogical process in organizational development. Gregory Kramer wrote a book. David Bohm did the dialogue. Gregory Kramer, a very advanced meditator that I sat with years ago, he got into this, and he would realize he'd go off on retreats, long retreats, studying on Asian stuff, and he'd come home, and he'd be just blissed out and so concentrated. He'd say within 4 hours of being home between the kids, the dogs, and the family, and the phone ringing, he'd be back and it's violent. So he took Bohmian stuff. He took the Dharma, the Eightfold Path that we talked about, and the Four Noble Truths and all these teachings, and he put them together into a formula called insight dialogue. Mindful speaking, mindful listening, honoring silence, the power of inquiry based on loving kindness and mutual respect. So the part, there's suffering and stress, there's the cause, there's the cessation, there's the way to do it. And that piece in the middle is so often overlooked in the West. We come to the cushion, we sit on the cushion, we do our meditation, we have some insight and everything. But when we start to talk about ethics and morality, I'm not going there, okay? But the way I practice, the way I teach now, it's threefold. Unfortunately, I didn't give us quite enough time, but we're going to play with it a little bit in just a second. The first part, I take refuge in the Buddha Dharma, Dharma nature, here and now. That's when we meditated. I take refuge in the Dhamma. Thank you for paying attention to this talk and my experiences with these teachings. The third part, I take refuge in the Sangha, is where we start to talk and dialogue amongst ourselves in ways that's useful. So that's where I'd like to go now for about 10 minutes, not quite, more like 7, as we wind up. And we'll be done in a minute, and then we can just bow out. But just if you have questions, observations, or experiences of your own that you'd like to share, just for a few minutes, so we can have kind of a group collective perspective.
Some people may feel repressed or not feel heard, and they won't speak unless called upon. How do you balance those things? Or for example, in some group dynamics, there will be an endless queue of hands, and you just won't get an opportunity, and you won't feel as engaged. How do you moderate or account for those?
That's a great question. My own personal experience is that I can relate to that question, number one. And I remember I was in group therapy for about 4 years, and it was a men's group, and we were like puppies around the food bowl. And when I was the first year I was in there, I was the runt, and I didn't know how to get airtime. And I finally got really angry one day about it. Why won't anybody give me space? And they said, why don't you ask for space? And I suddenly realized that I was conditioned to be that person you're describing who tends not to speak up. And it was incumbent upon me to take responsibility for myself. What is my need? Can I recognize that I have a need, whatever it is, and B, do I have the skill sets to ask to have it met? Am I adult enough to be okay if it doesn't get met? Because often it won't. And a lot of people who are shy, for whatever reason, that's conditioning. That's part of a conditioning thing, okay? But it's just a habit. But in the beginning, I'm shy. So I label myself shy. That's a sticky note on the wall, for instance. I believe it, therefore I'm shy. So can I learn? Can I see that? And can I say, well, gee, you know, every moment's a choice point. How could I learn this? I don't have the skills not to be shy. Oh, my God. How am I going to learn that? Let me see. Who seems to be skillful and not be? Oh, you know how to really show up. I'll just watch you. When I was on the board of IMCW, good, great. You know, I was the first treasurer, And I was good. I was good at what I did, but I didn't know how to be, when I had a viewpoint that was going against the grain of the mood, I didn't know how to express it without kind of feeling like I was an adolescent. And the treasurer that followed me, actually the second treasurer after me, I was still on the board, and this guy and I, he and I thought a lot, and we would often have the same perspectives. And I would sit back and I would just watch him and I'd go, wow, he'd be so eloquent and so profound and so effective. I said, I don't have the skill sets. I set out to learn skill sets. Because the only way I knew how to get into the food bowl was to throw a tantrum, to break something, to get, you know, because that's the way I grew up. I didn't know I didn't know. I was ignorant until something, you know. So it's a gradual process. And if we want to understand, if there's areas in our life where we're feeling stressed and being shy as one, I don't want to be a wallflower. You know, just it's just a habit, number one. Number two, it probably means I don't have the skills not to be. Go learn the skills. You learn to walk. You learn to talk. You learn to drive a car. You learn to add two and two. So in the areas where we want to improve or be better, or we don't feel like we're getting our needs met, listen. Practice rain. I recognize this is happening. I allow it and accept it, even though I don't like it. Or if I can't accept it yet, I accept the fact that I don't accept it. You know, you can play that game. And then investigate. What do I need? And the subconscious will tell us. Because we're all brilliant. We have these incredible prefrontal cortexes. We're amazing creatures. If we can get out of our own way and listen.